everyone, and welcome again to the Associate and Affiliate Cricket Podcast. It's been a few weeks since we've been on, but I'm joined as usual by my co-host, Andrew Nixon. Welcome, Andrew.
Hi, Russ. Hi, everybody.
Joined today by Paul Radley, a cricket journalist from the UAE National. Hi, Paul.
Hi.
Paul, you're there for the UAE versus Namibia games. We'll start with those. UAE went into them needing to win both, just have even half a chance of qualifying, which they did. We expected Namibia to be weak, but they were really, really weak, weren't they?
Namibia were terrible. In actual fact, yeah, the past couple of weeks weren't very good advertisement for cricket in Africa, beyond obviously South Africa, because Namibia were actually terrible against the UAE. And then the following week, the Kenyans were every bit as bad, admittedly against, you'd probably say, a more rounded team in Afghanistan. But to be fair, Namibia did bring a very young team over with, I think maybe with a view to the under-19s World Cup, perhaps later on in the winter, and also some of their senior players couldn't get time off work for a series that didn't really matter too much to them either way. But that said, they really should have put up a better show because they were poor.
Yeah. What did you put their batting down to? I mean, 39 is even worse than poor, really, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. And they sort of precursed it with a 2-day defeat in the 4-day match that they had before that. So they had had a chance to prepare and get a better idea of what they were going to be facing in terms of the very, very slow, low wickets and the UAE spin bowlers. But it seemed like they just didn't come up with a plan, apart from the wicketkeeper Kotsar, who did look like he was coming up with a theory of how to combat it. Nobody else sort of seemed like they came up with any theories as to what they should be doing. Admittedly, they are young players, as we said before, and they're playing against sort of wily old campaigners in the UAE spinners on pitches that were probably just about favouring. Well, they were obviously very different to the pitches that the Namibian players play on, but still, they just sort of didn't. It didn't seem like they thought very quickly or paid it much thought, basically, as to what they should be doing and what they could be doing to counteract the UAE bowlers.
On the UAE side, we've seen some remarkable forms from Shamin Anwar. Is there a reason you can put down to why he's scoring so many runs at the moment?
I can't. He even did the same literally yesterday. Was it yesterday or the day before when they were playing against Pakistan? Pakistan's full test attack. UAE played them in a warm-up game before the series against South Africa starts in Abu Dhabi on Monday. And he got, I think, 70 or 80 odd against their test match bowlers. And he looked pretty untroubled in doing it. And I don't see, I haven't put my finger on exactly sort of the secret behind his success, because he does look like he's just got a very normal technique. Nothing really stands out too much as to what Shamin is doing and why he's producing such big scores. But I've noticed that he is a little bit all or nothing. If you get him early, obviously that's a good time to get him, because after that he tends to check in with high half centuries or centuries. But in terms of the secret behind it, I've still not worked out what it is.
The Afghanistan games in Afghanistan obviously went in, they needed to win both to qualify. I think both and had really large victories. But again, Kenya just weren't very good, and perhaps surprising because they seemed like they'd started to turn the corner, but Afghanistan just overpowered them, really.
Yeah, I think you're right. They thought that they had turned a corner, I think, certainly talking to their coach, Robin Brown. He said that when they played in Scotland, it was a massive drawback for them because, like you said, they thought they'd turned the corner. And they stuttered in Scotland, and then coming over here, the wheels really did come off very badly. Because they lost the two important games, especially for Afghanistan, obviously, so they sealed their World Cup qualifications. But then in the 4-day game after that, Afghanistan only played like a second string team, gave a lot of chances to new young guys, and they still completely outplayed the Kenyans, and it's a real concern because obviously we know Kenya from the past, like 10 years ago, as being you know, the sort of the, probably the leaders in the associate world, having reached the semi-finals of the World Cup. And ever since then, well, on this evidence anyway, ever since then, they've just taken a complete dive.
So Afghanistan, though, I think the highlight for me was to see Hamid Hassan back, because he's really a fantastic bowler and at any level, isn't he?
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. He, it was really striking, actually, that he, I mean, you see any bowler at any level of the game, and doesn't matter how good they are, they'll usually, they need a little while to sort of work back in, especially if they've had a long injury layoff like Hamid Hassan's had. They need a little while to sort of get back and find their form. And, you know, you might say, oh, he's had a couple of looseners there. Hamid Hassan didn't have any looseners or anything like that in the matches he played here. He was straight on the money at good pace, swinging the ball. And it was really impressive to see, because obviously we know he's had that nasty injury that he got, that he suffered when he was here in Dubai. And it's taken him a while to get back. But he was, in fact, it was just sort of underpinned, just a really classy display for the Afghans. They knew exactly what they needed to do, and they weren't going to sort of sit around waiting for it to happen. They from the very first ball, Hamid Hassan was straight on the money. Shahbaz Ajran at the other end was the same. And it was a really high-class performance. It sort of reminded me a lot of when we've seen Ireland play over here. It seems like both those teams always play with a point to prove that they don't really belong in this company anymore. They're too good for it, and they want to show that every time they send the ball down, Hamid Hassan wants to take a wicket and wants to show how good he is. And that really came across in those games against Kenya.
I don't know if you saw the second 2020 game last night. Obviously, Kenya did a lot better in that game. Do you know what was sort of different about how they approached the game?
I didn't actually see. No, I haven't even seen. I was away doing other sports actually last night. So that surprised me that you said that, actually.
It's possible Afghanistan didn't perhaps care as much once they achieved their qualification and other things. Back on the UAE, Paul, obviously they've had a little bit of an advantage over the course of this tournament. They've played a lot of games at home. They've now got to go. First thing they've got is the World 2020 qualifiers. Do you expect them to qualify from that? Is 2020 something that they've got their heads around?
Yeah. It's a good game for them. But having said that, they got very close. The first time there was a World Cup qualifier over here, like you just pointed out, they benefit from the fact that it's actually played here. Obviously, they know the conditions very well. They're suited to those conditions. And they got very close. They were the next team. It always seems to happen to the UAE, whether it's 50 overs or World 2020. They're always the next team that could be qualifying. They would just miss out on it. And they did that the first time here when Afghanistan actually beat them and qualified. It was sort of quite an amazing scene at the Dubai International Cricket Stadium, where thousands of Afghan fans came to the game, and it was UAE that they actually beat. So in that regard, they are good, but they just need to find a way of sort of getting over the line in a very important game towards the end. And I think you were going to go on and ask just then about the series in New Zealand, the next World Cup qualifier for the 50 overs, a sort of second chance tournament. I think obviously the conditions won't be in their favour, so it'll be it'll be a real test for them to see whether they can do it there. And they should take a lot of confidence from how close they've got in this sort of 2-year World Cricket League, but that will also be massively counteracted by the disappointment that they'll be feeling by the fact that they were so close when they knew, like you said, a lot of their matches were played at home. Even the two matches against Afghanistan were obviously the equivalent of home games for the UAE, even though they were nominally away matches. They've had a lot of things in their favour in this tournament, so they may be a little bit worried about going over to New Zealand and what they have to do there.
I suppose the UAE bowling attack is currently very heavily spin dominated. It sometimes seems they only bowl about 10 overs of pace and then it's 40 overs of spin. Are there any pace bowlers sort of coming up through the ranks?
Well, the one that they played, it sounds ridiculous, but the one that they had sort of underpinning their attack here, you know, like you said, the one who bowls 10 overs while the rest are bowling spin, Mohamed Navid, he looked absolutely excellent. He looked pacey on pitches that were very slow and low. He was getting it through to hit the wicketkeeper's glove sort of about shoulder height. I think he, they definitely will put a lot of hope on him in New Zealand. And then past that, they've got another guy who played in the four day side called Kamran Shahzad, who's a little bit different. He's like a straight, if you look at him, you'd think he basically looks like the sort of guy who'd have grown up playing take ball. He's very strong across sort of the chest and shoulders, and he doesn't have much of a run up to speak of. He just sort of runs up and swings it down with a little bit of a swing action like Bellinga, say. I'd have thought he'd make the squad. And if they're going to play sort of more seam bowlers, then he'd probably be a good chance for making the starting lineup as well. And then there's also a third guy who's played a little bit of cricket and has made a few squads for the UAE, called Manjula Garuga, who's a Sri Lankan guy, who's very much of the ilk of Chaminda Vass, very, very similar, just a nice medium pace, who swings the ball back in and is very accurate. And I'd have thought he'd actually be a very handy bowler to have over in New Zealand, because obviously if you look at the New Zealand side currently, they've got millions of left arm seamers of that sort of ilk as well. So I just thought that they'd definitely try and get him involved when they go over there.
The other interesting thing I guess about the UAE is a lot of their players, Akram Khan particularly, I guess, are kind of, this might be their last chance to qualify for World Cup. Is that something that you feel plays on them a little bit?
I've often thought that, actually, yeah, because Kurram's had a magnificent career. He's done so much for UAE cricket, and it's a shame that he never has had that chance to show it at the very top level. And whether that weighs on his mind or not, I'm not quite sure. He's a very quite a laid-back guy, and perhaps he doesn't even think about it. But I thought he would do, and it's a shame now that if they do manage to make it through in the World 2020 or the 50 over World Cup, he'll be pretty old by the time those tournaments come round. And whether he'll be, you know, whether he'll be able to show his very best at that age or not is a moot point, really. And it's a bit tough because I've been lucky to play a lot, obviously, because I've got a UAE cricket. And it's a shame that more people haven't. There's a few people in that boat, like Saki Valley. In actual fact, they brought in a David Clark wicketkeeper for the Namibia series. He's 44, Mohamed Shafiq, and he's an excellent cricketer. But if they do manage to qualify for the World Cup, then you'll be seeing sort of pretty old. You know, they're not necessarily at their peaks, but and also, what with them being that age, is probably a lot of the time they'll be feeling, oh, is this last chance to win for me? So that adds, you know, a bit pressure to the matches.
And once they move on, what's the development like in UAE at the moment? Is there another team coming through that can replace these players?
In actual fact, the UAE have obviously got automatic qualification for the Under-19 World Cup because they're hosting it later this winter. So Akib Javed, the coach and his coaching staff, have been working very, very hard to prepare them because obviously they can't, you know, they have to be good in that tournament. So they have been making a committed effort to develop that team, which obviously is only going to be a good thing. But that has been a problem, actually, over the years. The fact that Kurram's still there, still the main man in the team, Saki Valley, the same. They have never been replaced by, you know, and young guys that have come in have sometimes been dropped and then discarded, and they haven't necessarily come up and reach the sort of levels that have been needed by the national team. And there's one guy, Ahmed Raza, who's 24, and Rohan Mustafa, I think 24 or 25 as well, who are two guys that are just, they're the next generation, but they're sort of the only two, basically. So I think they're hopeful that they'll produce a few from this under-19 side that they've been committing so much to.
One final question. It's been rumoured now a little bit that the ICC might be moving offices to Southeast Asia. Do you see that as something that could impact quite negatively on the UAE? Obviously, they've got a lot of the, you know, global development stuff locally at the moment because of the Dubai office.
Well, those facilities that they've got there that are sort of ICC related or ICC affiliated are always going to be there. So they've done well out of that. And in actual fact, in terms of bricks and mortar and pitches and things like that, UAE are absolutely spoiled in relation to a few test nations, I'd have thought, but certainly in relation to the associates, etc. All the other cricketing nations would be very envious of the facilities that there are over here. And the fact that if the ICC ever did up stick and leave, that wouldn't sort of affect that in any way, shape or form. But other than that, I suppose, no, I don't think that there'd be a massive knock-on effect. But I actually can't see it happening anytime soon, the ICC moving away. But if they did, I don't think it would necessarily impact too much on UAE cricket.
Cool. Thanks, Paul. It's very illuminating.
Also, it's a pleasure. It was really good to speak to you guys.
There's been some tours going on, Andrew, and tournaments. Hungary hosted a Three Nation 2020 tournament that involved Poland and a Croatian B-side. Looks like Hungary came up with the win in a emerging area of the cricket world.
Yeah, and I think it was played on Hungary's turf wicket facility that they installed a couple of years ago. So it's good to see another turf wicket being used in continental Europe. And they beat Poland in the final by 3 wickets. So it was, for the most part, quite a high-scoring game, apart from the match Croatia B played against Hungary, where Hungary won by 10 wickets pretty quickly. The scores throughout were quite big. Poland scored 197 against Croatia B. Hungary scored 189 in the group stage against Poland. And then the final was quite close. It was 165. Poland batted first. And then Hungary chased it down with about 2 overs to spare. So high-scoring game, high-scoring tournament, and good to see turf wickets being used in Europe, as I said.
The World 2020 qualifiers get closer by the day. We're seeing a few development tours going on at the moment. Hong Kong has been in New South Wales playing against under-19 side and won one, lost one so far.
Yeah, they started with a 50-over game, strangely enough. Not quite sure what the reasoning behind that was. But played against New South Wales in the 19s and lost by 78 runs. So didn't disgrace themselves. New South Wales scored 255 for 5. Hong Kong bowlers didn't bowl too well, with the exception of Nadeem Ahmed, took 2 wickets. Then Jamie Atkinson... 43 in their reply of 177. Jamie Atkinson, obviously fresh from making his county championship debut with Warwickshire recently, so obviously he's gained a lot of experience over the summer in England, and Hong Kong will be hoping he can take that back to Hong Kong.
And the MCC's been doing a development tour of Uganda and possibly Rwanda as well. Again, some mixed results for Uganda against a relatively weak side.
Yeah, the MCC haven't picked any county players for this. They usually have a couple of county players or a couple of players who have played in the MCC Universities match. They played a two-day game, which finished in a draw after sort of rain spoiled most of the second day. Played 2 one-day games, MCC winning the first by 6 wickets, and then Uganda winning the second by a very narrow margin. There's a notable incident in the first one-day game where... an MCC batsman was given out LBW from a quite obvious inside edge, and then the Ugandan players decided to call him back and withdraw their appeal. Obviously, there's the occasional debate about sportsmanship in cricket at the moment, and whatever you think of it, it is good to see some players being honest.
Other World 2020 qualifier news. We already knew that Darren Jones is coming back and Berg has come back for Italy as well, but there's rumours that... the Netherlands might see Dirk Nennis and Denmark might see Amjad Khan, which will scare a few batsmen.
Yeah, pace bowling this tournament could be very interesting. You know, when you add those two to the likes of Shapur Zadran and Hamid Hassan for Afghanistan, that's a pretty mean bowling attack. Dirk Nennis, I'm not sure where that stands at the moment. When I spoke to someone in the Netherlands in August, he told me that negotiations were promising. So hopefully Dirk Nennis can turn out for the Netherlands. Obviously he's now re-eligible for them under the new eligibility rule. It's now a 2-year wait since you've played for a previous played for a full member after previously playing for an associate to go back. Otherwise, he wouldn't have been re-eligible till 2015, I think. So he can now play in this qualifier, so hopefully the Netherlands can pick him, especially as it's not looking too promising that they're going to get Ryan Tenderskaarte. And Amjad Kaar for Denmark, there's been sort of rumours circulating all year about him, and there was a little thing on the Denmark website where they had a trial game, Denmark East against Denmark West, and Amjad Kaar turned out playing in that game, and I think he took a couple of wickets. So it's looking promising that Amjad Kaar will be back for Denmark in the World 2020 qualifier, which is great news for Denmark, and can perhaps with him in the attack, and if Freddie Klocker can bat as well as he did in the European Division 1, they're a potential chance of getting one of those six spots in the World 2020.
Tell me about Namibia again. A little bit sad to see that there's been more problems with accusations of racism in selection, and Piqué of France, who's been in and out of the side, was dropped, but was apparently only dropped to test out some different players, but then decided he didn't want to go to the matches in the UAE. And then has changed his mind and come back to the side for the qualifiers. It's a little bit concerning that the way things are panning out in that part of the world.
Yes, definitely. These accusations of racism have sort of hovered around Namibian cricket for a number of years now. I first heard them back in, I think, 2005. I think there was a incident in a one-day game against Bermuda where there was accusations that Bermuda players were being racially abused by spectators in Namibia. And the selection of players has long been a concern, and other sponsors are not very impressed at the low number of black players that have come through to the side. Piqué of France is definitely the best of the bunch of the black players in Namibia's side. And if you look at the one-day games he played against you, he was actually the top scorer for Namibia in both matches. So he's obviously one of the key players in the side, and I suppose they need to keep him happy. And whether Cricket Namibia need to actually introduce a formal quota system similar to that South Africa had for a few years after their readmission is a debate that needs to be had. And you never like to have some sort of selection system that isn't based on anything but merit, but perhaps in this case it needs to be done to avoid those accusations of racism in future.
Turning back to the matches gone and the World Cup qualification, let's chat about how it's gone as a project. This is the first time that they've had the World Cricket League Championship as a qualification process. It's, I think, the fourth Intercontinental Cup, or the fifth. That's obviously got the final still to play. Your thoughts on the World Cricket League Championship? Did it work?
I think it has worked. It went sort of right down to the wire. You know, we went to the last round of matches with, I think, five countries still chasing the final spot in the World Cup to join Ireland. So in that regard, it was a competitive tournament. So the teams were, with the exception of Namibia and Canada, were very evenly matched. And then obviously Kenya declined towards the end of it. But we're still in it up until, I think, they played Scotland in their penultimate round of matches. So it's been a successful tournament, and it's actually been probably the most exciting one-day cricket since the World Cup. The matches have been very hard fought, and you know, I think we've said it on previous podcasts before, only all one-day international cricket was like what we've seen in the World Cricket League Championship. You have to think that if you know, there's lots of talk about the future of the one-day international format, it seems to be surviving for a few years just yet, but you have to wonder, would a league system like this help one-day international cricket survive? If all one-day international cricket was played in this, if you had the top eight full members playing in a league like this, and perhaps playing games home and away instead of just one, you know, one game against each, well, two games against each team as it is in this, over a 3-year period, and then you have another eight team league played over 3 years with the bottom two full members and the associates, and then you have the World Cricket League sitting under that. That's actually a good model, I think, for the future of one-day cricket. I think a league works quite well for one-day cricket, where it doesn't necessarily work for multi-day cricket.
One thing I noticed is that there was quite a lot written after Afghanistan qualified, and mostly praising Afghanistan. So it's certainly, these matches, I'm not sure what the viewing figures were like, but they have certainly got us a level of interest from cricket people around the world and news articles that haven't necessarily had before. A little bit of ICC hypocrisy about Afghanistan, though, in their news media releases?
Yes. After all, it was the ICC who tried to stop this from happening. They originally had the 2015 World Cup as being just the 10 full members, because apparently the associates were only really good enough to be playing 2020 cricket. Obviously, this was announced just after Ireland had beaten England in the 50-over World Cups, which made it look even stupider. But then they were shamed into actually letting the associates participate in 2015. The TV contracts had it that the 10 full members had to take part, so they had to keep a 14-team format. The news releases from the ICC have been full of congratulations towards Afghanistan, saying how great an opportunity it is, and these is coming from the same people who tried to stop it happening. I think Jared Kimber makes a good distinction between the ITC and the real ICC, which is the full member boards who control all the decisions. I'm sure these press releases are being put out by the handful of good people at the ICC who do want to see the game develop outside of the 10 full members. It does open the ICC up to accusations of hypocrisy, and I think those accusations are well-founded.
Moving to the ICAP format, this has struggled a little bit, I feel. Obviously, the matches, it's a little bit harder for a weaker team to cause an upset, and so it's been obvious for a little while that who the qualifiers were probably going to be for the final, and also that just the number of secondary sides that have been sent to matches means that we haven't really seen teams play at their best throughout this tournament. It seems like the format, because it's multi-day and because they've got to get so much time off work, is struggling to attract the players it needs to actually survive.
Yeah, and you have the added problem that it's not a mandatory release tournament. So when Ireland and Scotland and the Netherlands are playing in the European summer, they're never going to have their county players available. There is the nagging thing of, what is it for? You can say what the World Cricket League Championship for. It's a World Cup qualifying tournament. It has context, to use that ICC term that they're so fond of. The Intercontinental Cup doesn't seem to have any context. There's nothing that happens. If you get, there's prize money, of course, which is always nice. It's not a fortune. It's not as much as what they get from the ICC annual grants or the TAP funding for the top teams. And what is it for? What happens to the winners? There needs to be something for the winners. Whether that's, it's unlikely that they're going to get test status on a temporary basis, as the teams get one day international status on a temporary basis. But can you qualify to perhaps take on Bangladesh and Zimbabwe in five-day games, whether they're official tests or not? I don't think it really matters. And there needs to be something, a cricketing reason to win the tournament, not just a prize money reason. And at the moment, I don't think there is. I think there's also, I don't think the a league works as well for multi-day cricket as it does for one-day cricket, as I said, when we were talking about the World Cricket League Championship. And I think the third Intercontinental Cup probably had the best format, where you have two groups of four followed by a final. You can get the entire tournament done in a year, and maybe that is the model that they need to look at in the future, because there's all sorts of rumours that the budgets are going to be cut and that the Intercontinental Cup is on the chopping block, and whether it can fit in with the future method of qualifying for the World Cup that will be in place for 2019. And maybe that two groups of four format, where teams are only having to play three games a season, or four if you get to the final, is probably best for the future.
Another option is something like a Davis Cup type format, where it's just a straight knockout from round to round, which means that obviously you don't get these dead games at the end, because every match is going to have to count. Obviously you have an issue with trying to end games that are going to be draws, or potentially teams just playing out first innings points. But it would kind of stop this problem of, which we've seen certainly in the last 2 months, of really weak teams being put out because there's no point having a team in there at all.
Yeah, and you know, the ICC seems to be serious about this World Test Championship, and you know, why not make it a Davis Cup style system from the, you know, right from the lowest level of international cricket right up to the top, with the other World Test Championship being the sort of finals of the of this competition. And, you know, I think that would be a very good format. I think it works with the Davis Cup in tennis, and you know, maybe it can work in Test cricket as well.
Thanks, Andrew.
Yeah, no problem.